Dr. Carol Comfort comes to us with a diverse background of working with families. A lot of her focus over the years has been families that have a substance abuse issue. And as anyone working with the audience we're talking about today knows, that's almost always a factor. It's not the whole piece of the person being incarcerated or the issues of the family, but it's probably a piece. We appreciate Dr. Comfort's sharing with us this morning. If you'll refer to your briefing report, we've also included an additional article of information. She has worked at the national level with substance abuse issues and is now at the University of Utah. As I was reviewing a lot of information to search for speakers, it started to strike me that I was seeing words describing these family members like invisible, lost, forgotten. Often the little ones are passed around among the remaining family members and then might even end up in the child welfare system. So Dr. Comfort is going to talk to us this morning about those families. Dr. Carol Comfort.
I'm going to move this over here. There's a little tongue. She's wanting to see the slides. I want to thank the Charlotte and Dr. Archuleta for this opportunity to come and speak to you today. I know you're policymakers and you're actually the ones who have to implement the different changes and work with the legislature. I used to work with the State Division of Alcohol and Drugs as the deputy director, so I have some idea. Of course, right now, all states are under huge budget deficits, and so you're trying to figure out how to do a good job with less money. And believe me, I think focusing on the family, doing what you can, you cannot give up what the services you have to provide to families, because that's the next generation. So my whole goal was, I used to do treatment in alcohol and drugs, mental health, and I was saying, why can't we prevent this problem? And we can. We know through strengthening families, improving the community environment, we can have an impact on creating healthier, happier children for the future, so that we don't have the horrendous problems we're having now with such increases in drug use and delinquency and crime in so many states. Okay. What I'm going to talk about today, quite quickly, is all of these things, the impact of incarcerated parents on the children, and family risk and protective factors, and solutions. So I want to move from the problems to here are some solutions, and then what you can do. So, to me, it's always a matter of connecting the dots, figuring out that this leads to this leads to this, and we have to not look at just the downstream, problems, but how can we get further upstream to start preventing these kids from having these problems and people from ending up in prison. But you can look at some of the statistics. Clearly, I am more in the alcohol and drug field than I am in the corrections or incarceration field, but by working with parents who are addicted, clearly a lot of them end up in prison, in and out of jails and prisons and probation, parole. So, and recently I've gotten very interested in effective parenting programs for prevention of child maltreatment, because our foster care costs are going so high, and adoption costs. So, the impact on the children. Some of this came from Dr. Pullman's research on children of incarcerated parents, and you'll see there that 50 to 80% of children of women prisoners were exposed to drugs in utero. So that's a very high percentage. And that damage is, you may not be diagnosed with feeble alcohol or drug syndrome, but effect. There are all kinds of effects on these children in terms of birth complications, very extensive problems that put them into the neonatal intensive care unit. And I was shocked when I was doing one study, went out to a place above Detroit where I actually got to pull the records of the neonatal clinic and then the postnatal clinic, and found out that there was one mother that they didn't screen for drugs. They said she just presented too good. She was white. She was one of the only white ones there. And she delivered twins that were severely exposed to drugs, the cocaine, and ended up for months and months and months in the neonatal intensive care unit at a cost of about $300,000 to $400,000 to the state. But I gotta move on. But I wanna mention one thing. that one of the problems of having parents in prison is this detachment from the parent, that if they are not attached, don't get the chance to have positive playtime with their children in the first couple of years of life, you can get what they call reactive attachment disorder. And it's a major problem that moves on as these children don't bond to any caregiver, a grandparent, an aunt, an uncle, or any, they don't develop attachment. Then later, they found that they end up being in the criminal justice system as people who perpetrate very violent crimes because they don't have empathy for anybody. So they don't, then even their teachers in schools, they don't respect authority figures. This is all the way back to what you learn in sociology with Bob, with the Hershey's and his research, but we have to move on to this. Okay. When I went to Washington, what I needed was evidence that we need to do programs for families, and that families are important. That for a long time during the 70s and 80s and early 90s, all we were saying was that if people do negative things, it's because of negative friends and peer influence. But there was a study done that showed that actually parents have a major impact on their kids for every kind of social and health problem. So what does the research say are some of the critical risk and protective factors? Some of you know this, but this was data that we had when I was the director in Washington for the Center for Substance Abuse Prevention at SAMHSA, 10,000 kids. We put it into a tested theory. We tested it with something called structural decisions model. So we have actual tested theory of what are the causes of negative outcomes in kids so that we can move upstream to start preventing these problems. And it turns out that family bonding attachment, which is love, care, support, attachment bonding, is the most important thing that you need with kids having that with their family. That leads to better family supervision, discipline, and monitoring, which is very important, and then better communication of positive family values. The final factor here, yes, was the peer norms and values, but it wasn't influence. It was values and norms, but the family values and norms collapsed with the peer norms. So kids were hanging out with similar kinds of associates and friends. So parents can't give up on their kids. The protective factors were these that you saw up there. Bonding and attachment is most important. Monitoring, discipline, predictable parenting, and communication of positive expectations and values. And here are some of the negative risk factors that you see in the families a lot. This was from a study that we did of parents who were drug addicts. And compared them to normal families in the same block, or community NASH families, and found actually the family conflict was twice as high as even the dysfunctional families on the national norm. So there's a lot of conflict in drug abusing families that leads to family violence. Did a study back in 1987 about what, if addiction is a family disease, and parents had come to me who were heroin abusers saying, we understand that we want our kids not to become heroin abusers, what can we do? And luckily, I also, that's what got me into this field, getting into prevention, helping them with parenting. It was when we got our first NIDA grant to develop the first program for addicted parenting program for addicted parents. But also about that time, I had money from the National Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatrists to look at the research literature to find out what it was, what do kids inherit? So if you look in your family history and you find there are a lot of alcohol and drug abusers in that family, what would you look for in your children to see if they're likely to have inherited any of the genes that would make them at high risk for addiction, which quite often is going to get them into being incarcerated because there's such an overlap. And these were the factors that we found. Overstress, what I call the overstress youth syndrome, they overreact to stressors in their environment in terms of the brain waves, the autonomic nervous system, overreacting. And one researcher administered alcohol to these children from what they call type 2 alcoholic families, which is the highly heritable type, and everything smoothed out. The brain waves smoothed out, the reaction of the autonomic nervous system smoothed out, and these kids are saying, this is the first time I ever felt normal. I'm partly mentioning this because we need to start looking at some of this as not a justice problem, but more of a mental health problem. They are actually inheriting differences that puts them at risk to end up becoming incarcerated. It's not entirely all their fault. We need to understand more these particular inherited kinds of factors that put them at risk for being incarcerated. So what are some of the solutions to incarceration? Of course, clearly, this is a family impact seminar, and I want to laud, you know, the New Mexico State University for doing this. I think this is wonderful. I'm going to try and take it back to Utah to do the same thing. But yeah, stronger families lead to stronger kids. And strong families avert many, many different kinds of negative outcomes in kids. Some more data, and this is from several studies. In our field of alcohol and drug prevention, there was one woman, Ann Tobler, Dr. Tobler, who had done what they call meta-analyses of which approaches work well for preventing alcohol and drug abuse. And through this meta-analysis, which is taking many studies and looking at how much the children changed, how much were they prevented from becoming alcohol and drug abusers, she found that the average effect size was only 0.10. And interestingly enough, the school-based affective or feelings-based programs actually came out with a negative effect, slight negative effect on average. And I went, oh my gosh, why is that? The only thing I could figure out was they were getting in touch with their feelings and going, hey, I'm a little bit depressed, I'm a little stressed, maybe I ought to go out and get some alcohol or some marijuana. That's all I could figure out. But the best you can do if you're working with youth only is life skills or social skills, which is teaching behavior change skills and reinforcing that. You get into working with family programs, all the effect sizes are 9 times on average larger. And the best you can do, I was blown away with how incredible the in-home family support programs came out in terms of the impact they were having on change in the families. Okay. These are some of the different skills that these programs do teach. Move on, you can read those. And so, you know, the other nice thing is that the longitudinal studies show that family interventions, the impact actually increases with time because you're changing the family system. Compared to if you work only with youth in programs, there was decrease each year. Child welfare outcomes, another study was that moving back into the court system, the drug courts and the dependency courts, judges were saying that they get better reports from the family service agencies delivering parenting programs if they're doing a program where they actually get to see the children, the parents working together, which is the family skills training approach that I know that you're doing in New Mexico with the nurturing program and also with my strengthening families program. Those are programs where it's not just parent education. Parent education alone does not work. You have to move into skills training and you have to have the whole family come together so that you can have them practice together. And that's where you get the larger results. Okay. Now this, Dr. Liguel is an expert in this, but I did take, and I haven't published this yet, I took data from Steve Ayles, who is at Washington, with the state of Washington, and he had done a cost-benefit analysis of many, many different kinds of corrections systems, juvenile delinquency programs, substance abuse programs. And when I went in there, I looked at all of the different types that he had for parenting and family programs and averaged their cost-benefit ratio. And the highest cost-benefit ratio came out for family skills training programs at $9.44, which is what you guys are doing, we're doing, luckily. I then averaged the juvenile corrections approaches for without any kind of family involvement. And it actually came out a negative $5.40. So to me, this is other evidence that you can get a bigger bang for your buck if you work with the family. So what are some of those evidence-based programs?
Yes. I'm sorry, is this stuff in the PowerPoint anywhere?
Yeah.
I'm just not following. Okay,
it should be the same slides.
Okay.
Yeah,
got
just flip the pages. Okay, so evidence-based programs are ones that have actual research results proving that they work. And also, not just that they are statistically significant, I'm pointing this out to you guys, because it took me a while to figure this out myself, but a lot of people will come up marketing their program saying, our program works. You know, we've got published, it has statistically significant impacts on this, this, and this. remember that statistical significance at the 0.05 level only means that your results are probably true results, that they could have occurred by chance only 5 times out of 100. But what was the size? They may not be clinically significant. They may be, as you saw for some of the youth-only programs, tiny little changes in the kids. It would mean that in a classroom of 30, maybe you didn't save even a single kid from using alcohol or drugs, because there was very little change at all compared to meta-analyses work with effect sizes, which is how much change did you get. In a classroom of 30, did you get 5 kids that were saved from ever using alcohol and drugs, or 10 kids that were saved from using alcohol and drugs? So hold on. Okay, policymakers are quite often wanting to know what really works so we can solve this problem. You can go on, Jane. The good news is we do know what are the effective programs to work with preventing alcohol and drugs. But the bad news is prevention is not easy. There are no quick fixes. So when I went to Washington, what I wanted to do, as we can move on, is that there's a huge disconnect between what researchers in universities knew and the programs that they had tested on research grants. But they're not encouraged to do any kind of dissemination. So during the 70s, 80s, and 90s, there was no bridge between research and practice. When I went to the federal government, I started saying, we've got to build a bridge. We've got to start doing showcase conferences of effective programs. We've got to get universities to come together to review what works. We've got to get websites up. We've got to start doing conferences. And we built a website and a program called the National Registry of Effective Prevention Programs and Policies, which the Department of Education is now part of at the federal level, and all of SAMHSA. So we now are getting a strong bridge. And the states have picked that up. They're also putting on their websites evidence-based programs. Universities are all working to help them with that. We had done for the National Institute of Justice, they were one of the first, interestingly enough, one of the first federal agencies to say 20 years ago, we need to know what works. And they contracted with us at the University of Utah to do reviews for about 18 years to find all the best parenting and family programs. It was called the Strengthening America's Families Initiative. And then we paired with CSAP. But this is what we found, is that there's different levels of evidence-based programs. And the first level is these exemplary ones, or it's sometimes called model. Each agency calls them different things, but they're the ones that have been replicated. So you have randomized controlled trials with good results, but also they've been replicated independently. Because you never know, if a program has never been replicated by anyone else, can you get the same result? When the great guru, or this charismatic knows the program, can actually do it. We found 7 of those. 7 of the programs, parenting and family programs, had good results but had never been replicated. And the others are ones that just had quasi-experimental studies, maybe multiple ones that had good results, but they were not done in good, true experimental design. And there were 5 that were promised, and we had to put on the website because they were political ones that the administration in Washington said we had to put on because they funded them a lot, and it would look bad if they weren't on the list. So these are what I call this is the best, the Miramar of parenting programs. And you'll have them in your book. And there are many kinds. They are treatment foster care, they're family therapy programs, they're skills training programs, and they're parenting programs. We can have good evidence-based programs, but you and agencies in the community are saying, but we can't get parents in. It's easy to work with kids in schools and just have the children come in to skills training classes, but how are we ever going to get the parents to come? With my own program, when we moved it out into the schools in Iowa through the Extension Service and Iowa State University, we had already started looking at all of these things. You have to remove all the barriers for attending, and you can get a very large percent of parents to come. There, it was even in the dead of the winter, January and February, we ran the program. And they did come back to the school at night. Personal invitations. We learned this from Little Anthony, New Mexico. We went down there, and the Hispanic women there didn't have the money for the training, start doing the program a year before. And when we came, they had already implemented all these great ideas. And one was, they were sending out personal engraved invitations to to the family. So it would say something like, the Jesse Hernandez family is invited to the Strengthening Families Program, time and date, location. Beautiful engraved invitation. They put them up, you know, on the mantle, reminding themselves, showed respect. And that was what important. If you want families to come, you have to show them respect in every single way. Meals, a meal is the big draw. And it should be culturally appropriate meal. And transportation if they need it, and childcare for the babies and the infants, and rewards for attendance. We give them little gifts. We actually, to get men in, we start asking the men, what would you like? And they'll say things like, you know, you're giving me out hand cream and body lotion. No, we want motor oil, things like that. You know, you never know what is, you know, what's important for them to come. So we got to get fathers in. And sometimes it'll be just find out what's the kind of meal they want. So sometimes we'll ask a woman, what does your husband really like? Well, he really likes barbecue chicken. So, okay, tell him next time we're having barbecue chicken. And he can just come for the meal and leave. And of course, they never leave. So, and weekly calls, check-ins, and a big graduation. A woman in Denver was the queen of big graduations. And on $250, she could do a huge graduation at the Sheridan Ballroom because her girlfriend ran the show. And they would bring in a mariachi band, just friends. And the kids would make pinatas, and they would have dancing and food. And they would invite the mayor and have the fire department sponsor them for Christmas because they graduate just before Christmas. And bring Santa Claus and gifts, all that. We're moving on. Okay. Money. What does it take to do these? Unfortunately, evidence-based programs cost a little bit more. It costs more in staffing time. Because if you were just going to do a 5-session parent education class with one person, that is a lot less expensive than running a nurturing program or the Strengthening Families program, where you need at least 4 group leaders, 2 running the children's group, 2 running the parenting group, and then working with the families all together. Or fast families and schools together take sometimes 7 staff people to run the program. So yeah, and they're longer. If you want to have an impact on families, the programs have to be longer. They can't be 5 sessions. They've got to be more like 7 to 14 sessions long. So yeah, it costs more money. But as you'll see, the impacts are much greater. You actually can have a true impact. Solutions are that I think states that are actually having their legislators, and this is what I was talking to the legislative people last night, actually earmark money for effective parenting and family programs. Having your states with their block grant money that you're getting from the feds or from your state legislature to start earmarking some of that money towards an evidence-based parenting and family program. So Congress earmarked, this was great for me, $13.5 million. Back in 1998, which was the first year when I came to Washington, to fund 142 communities to pick one of the evidence-based programs off of that website, strengtheningfamilies.org. And Esther was the one who came to our showcase conferences in Washington, and they got funded. So they were one of the lucky ones. And I realized last night that Jane was coming to Washington during the summer to work as an intern at SAMHSA. And they gave her the job of being the review coordinator for all of the Strengthening Families grants. So as all the grants came in, she had to file and photocopy them, send them out to reviewers. And so she handled your grant that got you funded.
Thank you.
I didn't realize there was a connection here. But you got funded, and that was wonderful. And I'm glad to hear that the program's still going. New Jersey legislature earmarked money, and we're doing it in 55 communities. Virginia has also, and they required local evaluators, and that they should all be published. So the legislature actually requires that the results be published. Arizona, now this is something you guys could model, and that was that the Arizona Governor's Commission on Crime and Substance Abuse actually mandated that any person in the state of Arizona who had a criminal offense that was drug involved and also had children, that they had to go through Strengthening Families program. They had to go through a family skills training program. And then they funded community agencies to do the program so that probation and parole could actually refer them to those agencies, and they would not be finished with parole or probation until they went through Strengthening Families. And they, in 1 year, just Maricopa County Probation Parole alone ran 800 families through the program. And that was the first that I knew about mandating. So other factors are, of course, training and technical assistance. Luckily, all of these researchers now have developed good training and technical assistance systems over the last 10 years. A lot of the programs are culturally adapted, and we found that that does help. That if you can pick a program that also matches the ethnicity of your participants, that you'll get about 40% better recruitment and retention for that program. Luckily, we've been doing trainings with mostly all the Pueblos here and up at Shiprock. In fact, this last weekend we were supposed to be training San Ildefonso, but they've moved it to January. And court referral systems. So getting the judges involved and the drug courts involved, family courts, really helps. Okay. So what you can do last is learn about these evidence-based programs. Get familiar with them. You just look at the sites, the websites will help you. Advocate for the funding, advocate for judges that we need to get these programs being offered. The judges don't have any money, so the money's got to come from somewhere else usually, unless they do fund an internal program. And of course, fund family interventions in prisons. So, thank you very much.
Can I just ask a couple of quick questions? Of the exemplary program that you listed here, are there some real commonalities among those seven programs? So that's one question I have. And then Strengthening Families, the way you delivered it, did you have like community agencies that you gave curriculum to and they delivered that?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm not in the business of marketing curriculums. I basically give it away. You get it on a CD, and then you can make your own cultural adaptations to it. So we have lots of different, we have cultural adaptive versions for every major ethnic group as well. And we encourage them to do more local adaptation.
And does it have a lot of home-based pieces to it, as well as just the family contact at the jails or prisons?
There's homework assignments. They have, every week, they have things they're supposed to do with their kids. And when we've done it in the jails and the prisons, you have to do the supervised time when they bring the kids into the jail or the prison, and they work together with the coaching from the group leaders or the therapists or counselors, whoever has been trained to do the program, and then they practice it at home. In some states, we are actually working with a home-based compound. In Maine and in some other states, Kansas, Oklahoma, they are also doing it through Child Protective Services, where they have case managers who are trained to then also reinforce when they go out weekly on their home visits or more than that, intensive case management, to actually work with them on their practice sessions in the home.
Okay.
And we're definitely gonna get better results that way, but we don't have the results in yet. About 2 or 3 years along in Maine, or we just started in Oklahoma. But if you can do both, I think the best is take a family skills training model that you can do in a group,
right,
you know, at the prison or the jail, having the kids be brought in by the kinship care or the foster parents or the case managers, and then also go into the home. The case manager goes into the home,
right,
and helps. But we had to get, with the Arizona prisons, we had to get real creative in ways that the parents could connect with the kids. And I'm sure that here you probably got other really, is it Lisa?
Trina.
You probably got some really creative solutions for how those parents can connect. I mean, they write letters, they send videos, we gave them phones, they can text messaging to the kids at home. Lots of ways that they can develop connection. Nancy?
I'm intrigued by the Arizona law and who initiated it, and is there a roadmap to the from the beginning to the end? Is there someone that could guide us in terms of legislation or creative legislation that might address that?
You know, unfortunately, I don't know. All I know is something like the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drugs.
But you know, the governor of Arizona is a New Mexican. She's quite a person. But I just wondered if there was somebody that you recall that was that might give us some guidance, because it sounds to me like that's a, we have a coalition that's forming right now
that has these interests at heart, and that sounds like a wonderful task for the coalition. But if there's someone there that could say, you know, don't go this route, go that route, it might be an interesting educational thing for us.
Unfortunately, we haven't been connected with them, and I think that actually that fund, what happened was that funding got dropped.
But the law remains.
I think so, yeah, because we then had to come back and train the probation and parole officers. They didn't have the money to fund all the community agents, which was a shame. But now the probation parole officers were running the strengthening families group.
That would be an interesting project for a graduate student.
Oh, it would be to do a history of it and what happened.
Yeah.
You know, and what the impact was.
Exactly.
And is the narrative said it was the whole state of Arizona, but then you talked a lot about just Maricopa County.
Yeah, those were the ones. They were the ones that we ended up training. You know, doing most of the training for, and then we went out and trained the prisons, the women's prisons, as well. And that was all over. It was all of the women's prisons in Arizona. But that was still 6 or 7 years ago. So it's been a while. We haven't really been. The whole thing could be dropped by now, as far as I know. But I thought it was very innovative to do that.
Maricopa County has some interesting. My mom lives there, okay. And it's interesting because their sheriff is always on the news. He does all this very interesting.
Oh, he does very.
I'm always amazed that. Yeah. In New Mexico, yeah. You would be in a lot of legal trouble, whereas there is, you know, we
do. I was doing site visits for the National Institute of Justice on different kinds of programs that were through drug courts and that, and they were doing, I went out and had rode around with police officers and probation officers who were going into the homes, and they had trained them in family therapy. And they were going into the home and doing family therapy where the youth were, and there was the first time I'd seen them where they had the trackers, and they were keeping them out of the prisons, and they were giving them home detainment. They had to stay in their homes, and they were training the families to do family therapy in the home with their kids. This is really unique, and it was working.
I have another question. There is some difference of opinion about the size of groups where this curriculum, meaning your family skills curriculum, is most effective. And you made a point that, you know, a culturally adapted group is better. But what about group size?
Yeah.
And that's one question. And the other question, we have a lot of court-appointed folks they are not incarcerated, but they may be avoiding incarceration, mm-hmm. or they may be coming out of incarceration. And those folks are integrated with everybody else. And so we have this very diverse group. So comments on the size of group and then the diversity with regard to the makeup of the group itself. Do they have to all be former incarcerated or avoiding incarceration?
Well, I personally think mixed groups are the best, where nobody really knows why they're there. Because then you've got some really healthy families that can help other families that have much more problems. But then also the families with less risk are learning about things that they had no idea were going on in the community, or what they need to watch for in their kids or their spouses or whatever. I think mixed groups where you have people with different levels of skills, because they're giving each other tips and tools and ideas. So it's not all just what the group leaders, the therapists are doing, but it's how they're supporting and helping each other. That's why I think you need more than just working in the home. Individually, they need that group support from other parents and kids as well. And believe me, when you do, and you've seen it, when you do the whole family group together, the kids are so happy. It's like, wow, this is so important. I'm part of with all these other grown-up parents, and we're all trying to strengthen our families, and they have such hope and such incredible And they will actually coach the parents. So you have to warn the parents that these kids will learn these ideas, these skills faster than the parents will, because they're young and impressionable and they want to do good. And they will learn faster and they'll start then coaching the parents. And we're supposed to do our homework. We have to do our special play. We have to, you know, you should have chore charts for us, you know.
How about group size?
And group size, I think, you know, it's going to be different for different areas, but what works is usually a medium size, I think. You don't want it to be too small. You don't want it to be down to two or three parents in a group, but you don't want it to be 15, 20 parents. I think somewhere between 8 and 12 families. It also depends on how many kids they have. We're working now with Pacific Islander parents. The first time we ran Pacific Islander parents for the Salt Lake County Housing Authority, oh my gosh, they were coming in with 8, 12, 14 kids. I had to immediately start at the university a class to train students. Week by week, had to do the next session. We got 40 students to start running. We had to run 3 children's groups for every parent's group. Because they were huge. And we're right now working with Pacific Islanders at the Hawaiian Cultural Center. We've only got about 8 families, but we have 50 people there. So, and we're actually doing that because we have now a physical activity curriculum for a half an hour before strengthening families, because it's all family games and activities. Because then they can work off all this energy. We can start bringing in nutrition, because nutrition is with the meal. And family physical activity to start reducing other health problems and obesity. Thank you.